You are listening to Investing Matters, brought to you in association with London South East. This is the show that provides informative, educational, and entertaining content from the world of investing. We do not give advice, so please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to this Investing Matters podcast. My name is Peter Higgins, and today I have the huge privilege of speaking with the former Goldman Sachs analyst, globally known and respected Neil Shah, the Executive Director of Content and Strategy at Edison Group. Edison is an investment research and advisory company with global offices. Good afternoon to you, Neil.
Hey, good afternoon, Peter. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us on this Investing Matters podcast, Neil. I would like to start, Neil, this conversation with the point that you graduated from London School of Economics. So you're already one of the bright sparks, you know, emerging talents of the economics world, right? With a Bachelor of Science degree in economics, then started your career at Price Waterhouse in 1994 in the banking, capital markets and treasury tax team. What do our audience need to know about the fundamental career drivers of you, Neil Shah, the younger of 1994, 95, 96?
So, I mean, I studied economics because I like to, you know, understand how the world works. And it's a sort of combination of social sciences and maths, which were two things I enjoyed. Behind it all is just someone who's curious about the world. I love learning about the world. I'm an avid sort of listener of podcasts, and I love digesting information. My dad, who was a profound influence on me, was an accountant. That was his profession. And economics is one of those subjects that it sort of qualifies you for everything and nothing at the same time. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And his suggestion was, well, go on and get a qualification first. It'll give you an opening into the working world. And so I didn't actually look that far. I went to Price Waterhouse, did the ACA qualification. It gave me a really good grounding. It gave me exposure to a range of different companies. And I kind of found my feet after that in terms of what I wanted to do. So this fascination with the equities market, what made great quality companies is really what sort of opened the door. So I was looking to get into equity research, and as luck would have it, I got an opening into Goldman.
Yeah, fantastic. I was going to go to that next. So in 1997, you joined the Pan-European research team at Goldman Sachs, specializing in covering construction and building materials. How did that come about? And tell us a little bit about your time there, please.
So it came about because one of my friends worked at Goldman, and they let me know that they were looking to hire someone into that team. I ended up working with Mike Betts, who was a veteran in terms of covering the sector. And look, I mean, it's one of those things that mentors are really important, people who've got a deep understanding of a sector. And if you look at equity analysis, the legend of equity analysis, Mike learned from a guy called Angus, and he was one of the very first analysts who actually took time to analyze. And we're going back, you know, many decades. Mike learned his trade through Angus, and then, you know, passed on that heritage to me. It was a really interesting time to join. So 97, Goldman was still a partnership. It was a very small equity research team at that point in time. And, you know, we went through effectively the dot-com boom, which was, you know, a lot of money flowing into the sort of equity side of the business. And my time there, the research team expanded considerably. It was interesting covering an old school sector at a time when internet and tech were in the vogue, which is good for me. I mean, I think I was able to learn my trade whilst not necessarily being in the limelight. Mike actually left Goldman after about a year of me being there, and I was given the opportunity to run the sector after a year. So it was kind of a sort of sink or swim type approach. You know, come in, my head of research backed me and said, look, I think you could do this, and I was grateful for the opportunity. And it was a really enjoyable journey. I mean, I think it was, you know, from a coverage perspective, it was covering a sector through a 7-year cycle, seeing the ups and downs. We saw the Asia crisis. We saw the dot-com boom and bust. We saw, I guess, a mildish recession towards the end of that period as well. And I learnt from some very, very good people. I was surrounded by, you know, some exceptional minds who were covering some of the other sectors, and I learnt a lot from them in terms of how you go about covering a sector. And then more broadly, I think, you know, what I saw at Goldman was a firm that had a culture of wanting to succeed, and navigating the equities business through, you know, firstly, the expansion, then, you know, actually running the business through the Spitzer reforms that came through and separation of investment banking and equity research. And trying lots and lots of different things to make it work. And I learned a lot through that period. And then, you know, after 7 years, I guess, you know, there comes that itch, a natural calling point in times of time for a change. And so towards the end of 2003, a new opportunity came about, and I decided to have a go.
Indeed. I mean, you left 2003 to set up Tusker Capital, yeah. A long, short hedge fund. So tell us about that. I mean, because that's a big step away from what you're doing at Goldman, and a huge responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, that came about because a very good friend of mine, someone I'd known, I grew up in Kenya, and a friend of mine from Kenya, we were both at university together. He was working at Morgan Stanley as a trader. I was working at Goldman in equity research. He was visiting Kenya and got carjacked and took a bullet through the head. he was very fortunate. The bullet went through his cheek and out his jaw, but he survived. And as part of that sort of process of him thinking about what he's going to do next, you know, I suggested, or we'd always thought we'd want to do something together. So we came up with the idea of a long-short hedge fund, setting that up together and launching it. And, you know, he's still running it today. It out of the very glamorous location of Manhattan Beach, it's done really well. He's an exceptional trader. I think what I learned from that entire process is, it's quite a lonely experience when moving from a big organization to a small organization. It's quite a lonely experience setting things up for yourself. And it was interesting in terms of, you know, marketing the fund to prospective people. I just felt, I learned that actually I couldn't switch off when it came to managing other people's money. I think if I'd stayed in terms of money management, my health would have deteriorated considerably. Yes. And so I, you know, after a while, I decided that I'd return into to my roots of getting back into equity research. And I started looking, but having done something entrepreneurial, I did go for, you know, interviews at various places. I remember going into the offices of Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank, etc. And there was a sort of small heart sink moment when you sort of walk through these large atriums of these very big buildings after you've done something entrepreneurial. And as chance had it, I met Fraser Thorne, who had set up Edison, in an office that was so small that actually all my interviews with him, or sort of conversations with him, were actually in the British Museum. I like that. I like that this was, you know, a small opportunity. It's something that, you know, I could sort of throw myself into. And that is how I sort of arrived at Edison. Fraser's actually looking for an analyst. I think I convinced him that actually what he needed was someone who could run the research team and scale up the opportunity. And it was an interesting concept at Edison. You know, I'm a big believer in equity research. Having worked in the industry for a number of years, I can see, you know, the impact it can make. The issue that the research industry, equity research industry, has always faced is that the funding for it has come consistently under pressure. And actually, you know, I'm sure we'll go on to talk about the UK Investment Research Review, but that is at the heart of the UK Investment Research Review, which is research is valuable, the funding, the traditional means of funding it are in decline. Edison sort of had this idea of taking a leaf from the bond rating guys' books, which was taking a retainer from the corporate and running an issuer-sponsored research sort of product. You know, at the heart of it, there's this big question as to if a company's paying you, you know, would anybody trust you? And I remember having first met Fraser, but my very first port of call was going back to my former heads of research at Goldman just to talk through, you know, what they thought of it. And I think my eureka moment in all of that was when one of them said that, look, ultimately research is a brand game, that, you know, if you can get the quality of the product right and associated with your brand, people worry less effectively about, you know, the sources of funding, etc. And I think that that's what I sort of embarked on doing at Edison, which was, how do I build a great quality research product, research offering? And that is what I've been doing for the last 20 years.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you for that full response. Now, we're in the month of January, so I'll take this moment then to just wish you a happy 19th anniversary with regards to joining Edison Group in January 2005.
Thank you very much.
So, Neil, can you just expand for me, please, and give us an overview of the understanding of your role currently as the Executive Director of Content and Strategy at Edison Group, and what that encompasses, followed by an overview of Edison Group, its solutions, Edison Research, its differentiated services, including investor relations, strategic consulting services, and of course, some companies that you and your colleagues work with.
Yeah, sure. I think the easiest way of doing that is to explain, you know, how we started and how the product evolved. We started as an issuer-sponsored research company. The value proposition that we put to companies was that we would write high quality research, including once a year a shelf note piece. It used to really irritate me when I was working in the hedge fund. Anytime I was looking for, you know, a meaningful note on a company, you might have to go back 5 years because, you know, most of the content was one pages produced on results. So one of the key things I sort of set out doing is that once a year there is a note that explains, you know, all the drivers of business, its business model, the management team, what it stands for, you know, how it operates in the market, it's the industries it's servicing, etc., together with the usual stuff of financials and valuation metrics and risks. We made sure that we cover companies at least once a quarter, so we cover things on a regular basis. The dissemination of that product is where it's very different from traditional sell side. Traditional sell side only send product to their paying clients. We made sure that we made it freely available to all classes of investors. So this includes your tier one institutions, but also you know, the smaller institutional investors, the private wealth managers, family offices, retail. And very, very quickly, the product, I mean, I think timing is, anytime you set up a business, timing is, you need a bit of luck, right? And if you go back to, you know, when we got going at Edison, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, it was at the tail end of the credit boom. You know, the UK market in particular was doing really well. AIM was flourishing. There was a lot of companies, particularly resources companies, etc., but lots of companies coming onto the junior market. Brokers were very, very busy in terms of listing these companies, and then a lot of these companies felt neglected in the aftermarket because, you know, their brokers had gone on to do other things. So it would come to us for the ongoing coverage, and very, very quickly, you know, the business built itself into something which was substantial in terms of scale. So, you know, covering at least 100 companies. The things that sort of surprised me from that point on, so, you know, we needed to validate our value proposition to the companies. And I think promising companies that you're going to drive their share price out was a false promise. There's so many other factors that, you know, reflect actually how a company does. So the way we choose to validate our value proposition is that it's going to a very wide audience and it's being consumed by, you know, the right kind of investors. And so, you know, we have analytics in terms of who is consuming our content. And as we sort of showed that to companies, I mean, you know, they were impressed that you know, their first time they were getting statistics in terms of actually who is consuming the research product. But it also led to, you know, a very immediate sort of call for, well, can you help us meet these investors? And so that is where our investor engagement IR offering started, which is organizing roadshows for companies and the readers of that research. And so we have we started taking companies out onto the road, meeting, you know, investors that they weren't necessarily meeting through their sell-side banks. And that grew into, you know, a very successful sort of second part of our business. Over time, the business started internationalizing. So this issue that companies have in terms of lack of understanding, lack of meeting the right kind of investors, lack of liquidity is not just a UK phenomenon. It's something that you're finding across all markets. And I think it surprised us at how quickly we internationalized the business. So, you know, very quickly we started picking up, you know, not just London listed companies, and which is where we're based, but European listed companies, North American listed companies, ASX listed companies. And we started to find, you know, an international dimension effectively to our business. And that helped in a couple of, it's symbiotic, you know, as you start covering international companies, your readership starts to internationalize as well. And so, you know, we started growing our international audience in terms of who's consuming the research content, but also then who we could roadshow companies to. So that's the bit that led to the globalization effectively of our offering. So today, you know, we operate out of London, but also have a presence in North America, in both the US and Canada. We have people on the ground in Germany, Greece, Israel. And I think, you know, what is interesting is that, you know, when we look at the readership of our content, it's read in over 200 countries. It's consumed. Last year, I think we had over 4 million people looking at our 4 million views of our content by over a million people. So it's wide, it's broad in terms of who is consuming that content. My title changed from Director of Research to Director of Content and Strategy, really on the back end of the pandemic. And I think there's two things that there have been significant changes that I would sort of reflect on. The first is MiFID II. MiFID II, you know, fundamentally changed the equity research market, and effectively put up a wall around a lot of content when it previously might not have, you know, more. It led to lack of accessibility to research content. The pandemic, I think, accelerated everyone's digital lives, right? You and I are here talking remotely to each other, and that's commonplace. What we saw in terms of the content was that traditional means of getting of that content being read, email, and putting it up on the platforms was slowly being substituted by direct search, and more people are effectively Googling for content and arriving directly onto our website. And our website's a really big call draw effectively in terms of how people consume our content. And I think that if you think about the way people find content, and I try and draw sort of real-life analogies for this in terms of how I think about my business. So, you know, if you wanted to go for Chinese food in Shoreditch, unless you happen to know the name of the Chinese food, your search term is generally going to be slightly more generic, you know, good Chinese food in Shoreditch. And I think that the way I sort of structured our content is understanding that search mechanism, which is people tend to search by thematics or topics first, and we've got two offerings in that. We have an Edson Themes, which is, I try and shy away from the big tomes of 80-page notes. I try and get our thematics in terms of, here's why this sector is really interesting or this particular theme is really interesting, but in sort of 8 to 12 pages. And then we also have a series called Edison Explains, which is, look, if you don't understand it, here's a sort of, you know, Q&A type guide in terms of giving you the basics. And that leads effectively people into finding, you know, the companies operating in that area, the space, etc. And the other end of it is that the demographic in terms of who's consuming our content also changed quite a lot through the pandemic. So it used to be, you know, middle-aged or late-aged people reviewing the Edison Research content, looking after their savings or their pension fund money. Increasingly, there's a much more younger audience consuming that content, and younger audiences like to view video, like to listen to podcasts, and so we've introduced the audiovisual element into the content as well. So the directive content and strategy is really reflecting the fact that, you know, how people are learning about equities has moved from just the traditional research product into a much broader suite of content, and which is why I call myself a director of content and strategy. Strategy is really trying to help companies use our content and distribution channels to help them achieve, you know, what we set out as our offering, which is to meet the right kind of investors. So we will tell companies that, you know, working with us, you will meet a broader group of investors and the right kind of investors who are right for your company. Companies that we work for, we work for some very large companies. So at the sort of upper end, you know, we work for Wheaton Precious Metals, which is, you know, several billion dollars market cap. We work for Melrose, which is a FTSE 100 company. We work for Greggs, which is a, you know, household name. We work for some really interesting sort of mid-cap names, things like Discovery IE. We also work with some smaller companies, some microcaps, so, you know, a Music Magpie or them. So we work across the spectrum in terms of market cap. And it's, you know, the idea of, you know, who uses us. It used to be that it's companies that, you know, were struggling for coverage. Actually, now it's the entire spectrum, because I think there has been a little bit of dislocation in terms of companies and being able to access the right kind of investors. And our offering allows them to find solutions to that. And we've got a great track record. On our website, we publish some statistics in terms of, if you look at our clients, you know, those which we've initiated on, we typically see an uplift in volumes trading in those stocks, an uplift in valuations on those stocks, and that is it's simple academic theory, actually, that, you know, if you put out content on equities, etc., they get noticed, and the more people that look at them, the more activity there is. So it's a pretty simple business in terms of what we do. I think there's quite a lot of appeal for companies in terms of you know, helping them achieve their goals, and that's why they come and work with us.
Indeed. I mean, you spoke about some of the companies you work for there, but what you didn't touch on, and I will add this in here for you, is that over the last decade or so, Neil, you've worked, or Edison have worked, with the top four performing stocks in the FTSE 250. They were Edison clients. And of course, I'm referring to Four Imprint, Games Workshop, PPH Hotels, and Entertainment One, which of course got taken over by Hasbro for $3.8 billion in 2020. You've covered it more or less covered it already, Neil, but please can you share where permissible, what has led to Edison's outperformance for said clients?
I think, firstly, I think there's a certain amount of self-selection bias when companies come to work with us. I think the companies that typically engage or pay us to work with them, firstly, tend to be on the front foot. They feel that, you know, they're directionally going it somewhere. They feel that they're misunderstood in the market, that the valuation's in the wrong place. So it's very rare that a company that's about to have a profits warning would engage with Edison, right? I mean, sometimes they do because they want to explain the profits warning. And I think actually that is a sensible thing to do in terms of engaging with investors. But by and large, most of them feel that, you know, their management teams feel that our valuation's in the wrong place and that, you know, we people are not necessarily appreciating where the business is going. So I think there's a certain amount of self-selection. There is a self-selection bias in terms of the clients that come and work with us. The second is that they care about, you know, they companies who engage with us, they all care about investor relations, right? Again, it's one of those things that that engaging with shareholders matters to them. And I think that's another reason that you actually, they're putting time and effort effectively into this, and that helps in terms of performance. And then finally, it is that simple thing. There's lots of academic research out there that says that, you know, if there's additional content effectively on these companies, you tend to see, you know, impacts on volume, on valuations and volumes. The key is that most of that is qualified and hence it needs to be credible content, right? So it's the fact that, you know, we put out what we think is good quality research. You know, we stand by our brand. We're not there to puff up a company. We're there to provide a balanced view of a company. And I think, you know, we've won hearts and minds on that. And you know, you can evidence that by, you know, the readership. Lots and lots of people consume our content, the longevity, and ultimately, you know, the kind of clients that work with us.
Indeed. Yeah, thank you for that full response. You touched on quality there. Fund manager Terry Smith, the founder and CEO of Fundsmith, has been referred to as the English Warren Buffett after achieving superior investment returns with strategies similar to the legendary investor Warren Buffett. Terry Smith is quoted as saying, when it comes to generating good returns, the most important thing is quality. What, in your view, are the best research strategies available to private investors to enable them to find the best quality companies now?
So let me, we run what I call a quality model portfolio, Edison, called the Illuminator, and actually it will be made available on the website on Monday. So when people come to Edison Group on Monday, that's Monday the 8th. I don't know when this podcast is going to go out, but you know, you will be able to see it. It's worth talking about the origins of the Illuminator. So when I was at Goldman, I met someone who managed private client money, and it was notable because he turned down partnership at Goldman, and the reason was that he was making more actually running private client money, and the his thesis was pretty simple, which is that to generate alpha you need an edge. And he told me that, look, I can't tell you whether this biotech company is better than another biotech company or this tech company is better than a, you know, another tech company, but he said that I can tell you what the attributes of a high quality company are. You know, he ran through a series of metrics which I took to heart and thought, actually, that's really smart. And because at Goldman I was in a position where Mike left, and I was running, you know, the coverage of my sector by myself, I created effectively proxies for all these metrics, and so pulled in financial metrics that would reflect the things that people thought made up, you know, a high quality company. These are things like they need to be growing in excess of GDP. So that's a simple metric. You know, you can look at forecast growth numbers. That, you know, they've got the kind of product or their service is effectively generating a return, which means that they're not going back to shareholders to fund their growth. And that's an ROE characteristic there, or a return on capital characteristic that you're looking for. That their balance sheet is in a position which allows them to, you know, have some tax efficiency, but also weather cyclical shocks. So it's modest balance sheet positioning. That they've got a product which is, you know, scalable and internationally attractive. They've got a management team which is working in the interest of shareholders. And it's a series of metrics that we look at, which we call the Illuminator. And what we do is we rank the UK market based on these metrics. And we pull out the top 10 and have had them in a model portfolio. Now, that model portfolio has been running since 2008. And don't, the rough statistics for you, if the FTSE All Share during that period, you know, went up by somewhere between 130 to 150%, the model portfolio went up by over 1,000%. The actual statistics we quote on the web page. So, I mean, it leads to substantial outperformance. And what it's actually picking up is early stage outperformance of companies which are showing the right kind of metrics. It catches them quite early, and then, you know, we see that grow over time. One of the names currently, some of the names that we have in the portfolio, the model portfolio, well, Rolls-Royce is in there. Had a stellar 2023. Again, it sort of turned around the civil side of the business. I think will continue growing over the next year. But also, we like the leadership team that's driving Rolls-Royce. Rightmove is in there, and, you know, had some wobbles because of the sort of rate hikes and also some competition potentially coming in. But it's one of those platform stocks that, you know, once you've got a dominant position in a particular market and you've invested in the technology, etc., your return on capital is fantastic, and it's actually very hard to it's very hard effectively to displace that. And I think Rightmove is exceptionally well positioned. Serica Energy is in there, which is, you know, a mid-cap, which has done some fantastic things, kept a very low profile, valuation's extremely attractive. I think the Tailwind acquisition is going to lead to, you know, some better returns going forward. And interestingly, the company that sort of came in towards the latter end of this year was a business called Global Data, which just in December actually had a spike because they had a private equity investment in one of their divisions. It led to a spike effectively, and it was reflecting the fact that the valuation wasn't actually for the business, wasn't necessarily what was fair for the business. And I think there's further to run on that as well. And so we identify sort of 10 high quality names in this model portfolio using the strategy, and there's much more detail on the website to get into, and it tends to be relatively low turnover. So usually we see one company drop off the list every month and one company replace it, and it's got a great track record in terms of identifying companies that outperform the market. Last year was a tricky year in terms of investing. So when I look at the Illuminator, you know, it's 1, 3, and 6 month performance metrics were actually outbeat the market last year, but on a 1 year basis it lagged. Now it was because I think we're in a slightly weird year, and we do see this, and that, you know, sometimes high quality companies aren't necessarily rewarded, but over time I believe they will be. So the other thing I try and do is actually identify, you know, companies which have been oversold. So I will tend to look at companies where I think they look fundamentally cheap on a valuation basis, and that they're in an industry where there is, you know, potential activity, consolidation activity. And I think that's another strategy effectively that I look to run in terms of, you know, trying to identify companies that are going to lead to outperformance.
Indeed, I think that's a really good strategy there. I think it's wonderful that you've spoken about the Illuminator portfolio and the fact it's had such significant outperformance, and it's reiterates the value of picking quality companies but holding them over the long term as well. Because what we're seeing now, I think I saw some piece of research which was saying that the time frame for investing now has gone all the way down to sub 6 months, Neil, which I find absolutely staggering. It's almost like everyone's a trader now.
Well, look, I mean, I think that's the time and time again. We talk about the power of compounding when looking at investing, and it's the, was it Einstein who said it's the eighth wonder of the world? And I think that's what you find, which is that actually holding on to these companies over a period of time is where you're going to start to see effectively those returns, come through. And that's why I think it's interesting that the turnover of the Illuminator portfolio is very modest. I.e., if you've got 10 names, one does drop out, but your holding period for a lot of these companies is long. And there've been some companies, Rightmove has been in there for many, many years, for instance.
Brilliant. Now I'm conscious of the time where we've got allocated for this interview, so we must talk about, Neil, the investment research review, which is aimed at bolstering the UK's capital markets, which need all the help they can get, to be fair. The review was led, or is led by Rachel Kent, was launched March 2023. Where are we since the review commenced? And please can you share with us the seven key recommendations made by Rachel Kent.
I won't get into all seven, but I'll focus on the ones that I think matter.
Yeah, focus on the ones that matter to us as investors. Yeah, thank you.
So Rachel, look, I mean, let me first say that one of the things that motivates me in terms of my role is that post financial crisis, I became aware of the fact that exchanges around the world were being asked by their treasury departments as to, what can you do to help facilitate the flow of capital to our SMEs. And that there is a really good reason for doing this, which is that if you look at economies that flourish, it's the vibrant SME sectors that lead to that happening. And because these are the companies that tend to be the growth companies, the ones that tend to expand and employ more people, that end up paying more taxes, that fund public services. And so looking after that segment is really, really important. And we started working with exchanges around the world, actually, in terms of addressing this. And so I feel like I'm in a very privileged position because I've had direct exposure to conversations with not just the UK, but what the ASX, the New Zealand Stock Exchange, Singapore Stock Exchange, Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, the Deutsche Börse. We've looked at a range of different exchanges, a lot of them implemented what we call intermediated solutions to help their companies with some of the challenges. And in two instances, we actually helped deliver the service. So for the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange and the Deutsche Börse. And so when Rachel Kent was doing her stakeholder feedback, she ended up talking to me. I kind of explained, the work we'd done and the fact that actually the Deutsche Börse scale scheme, when it launched, its volumes were, I think, 100% higher than what the companies that had migrated onto it had previously. The Tel Aviv Stock Exchange scheme that we helped on, again, saw similar kind of impact in terms of volumes, valuations, but also follow-on capital. So, I'm a big supporter in terms of the work Rachel's done. I think she's done a fantastic job in terms of articulating the problem. And the problem is that there is a funding issue in terms of research. Research, she talks about this golden thread, effectively, research being the golden thread that holds capital markets together. And she has outlined a number of solutions to help that. The first being to create a research platform, and we'll get into a bit more detail about what that entails. The second is to give fund managers some more optionality in terms of paying for research from the asset owner run P&L. So it's not quite rebundling technically, but it's effectively passing on the costs of research back up to the asset owners. She's called for some regulatory reform in terms of, if you look at the FCA handbook in terms of research, it's a hodgepodge of rules, etc. So some clarity in terms of you know what the rule book is, and this is important because actually quite a lot of people shy away from making research publicly available on the guise of there's a big compliance risk behind it. She's called on actually drawing academic, you know, us leveraging our academic institutions in terms of the research work, some reforms to the IPO timetable were proposed, and a couple of other things, but probably the most important and all of that is the creation of a research platform. What is the research platform? In essence, it's basically, you know, part of the reason we've seen companies, the great de-equitization of the UK market, part of that is just the costs of being a listed company are very high. The cost of liquidity is high, you know, if you think of yourself as a listed company. And you know, if the solution is to actually get notice, you've got to pay for more research, it's just another cost. So Rachel has suggested that there is effectively a stamp duty rebate that pays for the provision, the dissemination and provision of research for UK listed companies. And you know, so in essence, a company which feels that I'm misunderstood or I want more coverage can approach the platform. The platform would use effectively, you know, public funds to source and provide research from people like us or brokers, etc. But importantly, make sure that that research is freely available to, as you know, retail investors, all classes of investors via the research platform. Where have we got to in that? I think we've got to the point where I think Jeremy Hunt agreed with all the proposals in the Mansion House speech. Some disappointment that actually we hadn't seen much activity in the autumn statement. And if I was guessing, I'm guessing that you know, we'll probably see some further progress towards this in the March budget. So this is pure speculation on my part, but we're in an election year. The talk of the Great British ISA didn't materialise. Maybe it does in March, but accompanying that will probably be some decisions around the research platform. And actually, I think you know, quite a lot of work has gone on behind the scenes. The Treasury Department has done quite a lot in terms of what kind of platform do we want, and hence what is the cost of running that platform, and then what is left effectively to fund the provision of research. So I'm hoping that we'll see some activity around that. If we do, I think it might be, you know, a great time to look at some UK stocks. One, the UK is by all measures, I mean, you'll have had other fund managers on the podcast, etc., talking about the fact that the UK is cheap. So I think
occurring.
Yeah, so and accompany you know, add to that you know, there is an interventionist measure effectively to make more information available on UK listed companies and to level the playing field and to access a wider sort of community of investors through that, and our experience of that typically leads to an uplift in volumes and valuation in other schemes. I think it might be, you know, that it might start to reverse the fortunes of the UK, and it's one of those, you know, if the UK is going through a death spiral, there's a chance of reversing that. And actually, you could, once you start to see that momentum, I suspect you'll see, you know, more and more UK activity taking place. So I'm very hopeful that you know, the research platform does move forward. It's the boldest thing we've seen. From all the sort of work in the other markets. So, you know, I hope the UK, you know, takes the chance and implements it. But at the end of the day, it's politics and you never know, right? So it might end up just you know, being a lot of noise and we never see execution on it.
Well, I hope we do see some action. And I know that you're keeping everything crossed as well, Neil, so we get some positivity through this political year. You almost touched on it, but I'm going to ask you a bit more there. If we do see some catalyst in 2024, for whatever reasons, who do you and Edison Research Group see as some of the potential immediate beneficiaries within the UK markets?
So I think firstly, it's going to be a lot of those companies where, you know, their valuations are completely in the wrong place for the kind of businesses that they are. And that, you know, whether that's, and that they haven't necessarily explained what they're doing particularly well, and I think some more research. So think of something like Team 17, which took, you know, a hit at the back end of last year. But actually, I think, you know, the gaming industry, if you look at the long-term drivers of the gaming industry, it's an attractive industry, and over time, I think that those kind of companies would benefit. A business like Costain, which, you know, has had its ups and downs, but I think is going the right kind of way, but just is not particularly well understood by the market. Look, I mean, I ran a round table for Rachel and put 18 IROs in front of her just to have a discussion about the UK research platform, and two really big themes sort of emerged from that. So just in terms of constituents, I tried to replicate what, you know, in 18 names, something like the UK market. So I had four FTSE 100 companies, a clutch of mid-caps, and some micro-caps, small-caps around the table. The feedback that I think sort of came through was that a lot of companies find that their marginal share price is set by the retail investor currently, and that investor is not particularly well informed. And it, you know, the examples were that, you know, when a company says we are going to meet guidance or expectations, a lot of investors who don't have access to consensus and data platforms, etc., just don't know what that means. So having research that is made available is useful. I also think that, you know, it's one of those things that we pick up when we're comparing UK companies to US companies. US companies will often put out a point estimate that this is our guidance, you know, for the year, make it very publicly available, it's directional, we know where they're going. UK companies often don't, and I think just that sort of clarity in terms of where they're going is going to be important. The other, the theme that emerged is that a lot of companies felt that they weren't necessarily meeting the right kind of investors, and I think the platform will help in terms of connecting them to long-term capital rather than short-term money.
Indeed. I think you touched on the valuations there, and we spoke earlier about the cheapness of some of the companies and the fact that they're neglected or they don't get their communications out there to investors. In 2023, Neil, the FTSE Small Cap and AIM indices were busier indices with regards to, of all things, takeovers, as they witnessed 13 and 20 takeovers respectively. The average bid premium was 50%, Neil, which reflected the depressed valuations of so many UK smaller companies. How do we go about, and you've touched on it already there, how do we go about ensuring that companies A, get out the message, and B, retail investors and institutional investors actually engage, purchase, and value our companies accordingly?
So the takeover stat is notable, and look, I mean, the UK is, you know, if I was a private equity fund, I would find buying into the UK a very attractive proposition. Valuations are cheap. They tend to be sort of sensible companies, good rule of law, all of those kind of things. And, you know, if you look at some of the names that have been bid for, I mean, I remember looking at HomeServe, for instance, where, you know, actually a sizable part of its business was in the US, and yet you were buying that business at a very low multiple compared to what you were buying in the US. So I do think that there is scope effectively for those valuations to unravel. the in terms of how do we address those changes, I mean, there is no silver bullet to it, but I do think that the research scheme will help and the research platform would help considerably. And why is that? I think, you know, markets like momentum. You know, it's one of those things that the moment you start to see interest and share prices going in the right way, there's this sort of, you know, it continues rolling. And that's what we've seen in some of the other markets, which is, you know, when the Deutsche Börse ran the scale scheme, you know, there was more research made available. Importantly, the research was all in English language, and one of the very big things that they saw was a much larger international audience coming and looking at these German companies, because there was, you know, research in English that was explaining what these businesses did. The same thing for the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange scheme that we ran. So I think that, you know, making more research available, it's not going to be the domestic changes effectively that, you know, it's that international investor coming in and looking at the UK. I also think, look, I mean, it's the fact that, you know, you are seeing some pension fund reforms taking place, that there is going to be at the margin some institutional demand for our UK stocks. So it's a combination of, you know, these two things. It's making more content available, attracting more investors, explaining these stories better to investors, whilst at the same time, you know, creating a little bit of a demand push. And if you get that right, you know, it's a virtuous circle. You know, I think you'll start to see the UK suddenly move on to the front foot. But you need to see these schemes implemented. And I think that's a part of the frustration is lots of noise about it, etc., you know, around the Mansion House speech. But we haven't seen any execution yet.
Indeed. Now, we spoke of cheap and undervalued. You then spoke about the virtuous circle. There seems to be a virtuous circle in 2023, Neil, regarding the phenomenal growth of US artificial intelligence related plays. Yeah. And we got introduced to the new phrase now, which is the Magnificent Seven. Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, Apple, Google, the parent of Alphabet, Nvidia and Tesla. Obviously, they outperformed immensely during 2023. What is the synopsis of Edison's research regarding the outlook for the Magnificent Seven? Do you guys have any favorites, or are you thinking, whoa, you know what, there's no chasing these, let's just back off a little bit? What's the thoughts from the group?
So the you know, let's take the AI part first. These are phenomenal names, firstly. They are, in many ways, naturalistic monopolies. So they are going to generate, you know, exceptional returns. It comes down to risk-reward, right? And what you're seeing of late is that the valuations of these companies, particularly when you saw that sort of last quarter spurt in equity prices, have continued to expand. Yet the growth rates of these businesses have declined, right? So, and that is a real challenge. At some point, you know, you are probably going to see people wanting to diversify out of the Magnificent Seven. I don't think we're there yet. I think there's further to run. And the reason why I think that there's further to run is the optionality piece. So if there are going to be winners from the AI race, my bet would be that the companies that are most likely to capitalize on these are the Magnificent Seven. They're best equipped effectively to win their AI race. And so when you're looking at the growth rates, perhaps you're not necessarily factoring in the impact of AI on the growth rates going forward, right? So I think that there's good reason to have exposure to them. When I talk to professional managers, you know, what they're doing is that they think AI is going to be a dominant theme for the coming years, and they are doing a lot of groundwork in terms of the other companies to take a look at, the SMEs, and at some point they're going to pull the trigger on that, you know, and move away from the Magnificent Seven into you know, the smaller companies that are being exposed to the AI thing. And this is not just, you don't need to look at tech companies. I did a interview with Polar Capital, who identified RELX as a company that is benefiting, you know, from AI, because, you know, their legal service is now empowered by AI, and that becomes quite an interesting play. So you can buy into that AI theme at a slightly more reasonable valuation than perhaps the Magnificent Seven, if you look at it. And that's where I think the diversification is going to come that way. And so I would put a lot of work into, you know, the companies that are exposed to the AI theme, but are not necessarily the mainstream sort of Magnificent Seven. I my personal view is I'm very neutral on the Magnificent Seven, in that I think the valuations are stretched, but I can see an argument for the growth perhaps being underestimated by the market.
Yeah, RELX had a fantastic year in comparison to most of our FTSE 350 stocks. I think it managed over 30-odd% for the year. So a really, really good call there with RELX. Neil, I'm conscious of the time, so I'm going to ask you one last question. So this is where I'm going to give you the magic wand to do whatever you want. You're in charge, yeah? So this is my fun question. So I'm going to ask this one, conscious of the time. I'm going to give you the complete autonomy of the UK equity markets, Neil. Given said power, what thing would you change immediately to change the UK equity, capital markets, investment industry, and to place it on a better footing than it was yesterday and is no longer faced with a valuation discount to its US counterparts?
Right, so I think that the answer to that is not one thing, but a series of things. The first is, I think we've got to get better at creating national champions, you know, the standout companies. The we don't have an Apple, we don't have an ASML, etc. It used to be that, you know, a BP was a shining light in the oil industry, for instance. And I think that what we've got to get better at is supporting our growth companies, and part of that comes from the education effectively of our institutional investors in terms of supporting those growth companies, which then leads us to, you know, the second piece, which is I'm a huge supporter of the research platform, because I think the creating that ecosystem, creating effectively more information to help people make the right kind of decisions around that, is going to help unlock some of those valuations and create effectively the right kind of environment for our UK companies. And then thirdly, I think it's actually, you know, empowering effectively the retail audience to participate more in the UK market. I mean, we're underweight compared to a lot of the other markets. So I think 10, 11, 12% UK retail participation in UK equities, 22% in Scandinavia, 40 or 50% in North America. And, you know, re-engaging that audience back into, you know, our UK companies is going to be key. And part of that is helping them have the tools to make the right kind of choices. And I think a lot of them are still in the dark.
Fantastic reply, Neil. Thank you ever so much. Ladies and gents, that was Neil Shah, the Executive Director of Content and Strategy at Edison Group. Thank you ever so much for sharing your insights with me, Neil, on this Investing Matters podcast. Delight speaking with you today. Wish you all the very best with everything. Wishing you and the team an absolutely fantastic 2024. Take care. God bless you.
Peter, thanks for having me on. It's been a huge pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Investing Matters. Be sure to check out the London South East website for free tools and info to research your next investment. You can also join in the conversation on our social media channels. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more content, including our CEO interviews. Catch you next time.